We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. On April 20th, an explosion destroyed the Deepwater Horizon oil drilling rig in the Gulf of Mexico. 11 workers were killed, and in the weeks since, oil from the damaged well has been leaking into the waters of the Gulf. Officially, the figure that people have been using for some time now, it's the figure the government uses and also BP uses, British Petroleum, 5,000 barrels a day. But many scientists have looked at what we can see and tried to think about what we can't see, at least not very well, and suggest that this number could be even higher, much higher. And there are some people who predict that this could turn out to be the worst environmental disaster in our nation's history. Well, this morning, in this hour of Focus, we have two environmental scientists who will share some of their thoughts with us on the extent of the damage and some of the potential for recovery. Our guests are Edward Overton. He's emeritus professor at the School of Coast and Environment at Louisiana State University, Baton Rouge. He's a chemist by his training, and he's interested in things like environmental monitoring and applying analytical techniques and chemical principles to emergency spill responses, and also developing methods to detect, assess, and mitigate environmental chemical hazards. Also joining us is Mark Hester. He is a wetland coastal plant ecologist, and he works at the Coastal Plant Ecology Lab at the Department of Biology at University of Louisiana, Lafayette. He's interested in coastal plant ecology and restoration ecology, with particular emphasis on the use of vegetation to restore degraded wetland and coastal habitats. They're both joining us this morning by telephone. We're pleased that they could be with us. And as we talk, of course, questions are welcome. I'm sure they'll do their best to answer questions that people might have. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you're listening, like to join the conversation, you can do that either by calling us. And if you're in Champaign, Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. Calls on us. That's 800-222-9455. And you may also email your questions to will-talk. And that's just as it sounds, WILL-talk@illinois.edu. Well, Professor Overton, hello.
How are you doing today?
Good, thank you, and glad to have you with us. And Professor Hester.
Good morning, David.
Very good. Well, I appreciate both of you giving us some of your time. Maybe I could ask both of you, I'm not sure whether you how well you'd be able to answer the question, but I'm curious about your reaction to this business of trying to estimate just how much oil is leaking. The 5,000 barrel a day figure, I think, at least was the one that for a while the government was using and BP was using, but also there has been apparently some criticism of that because that's based on looking at the surface. And there apparently is serious oil leaking down deep, and some people have estimated that we really could be talking about a lot more. Maybe I would ask Professor Overton, do you have any thought on this whole business of trying to estimate the amount of oil that's leaking and why it's so difficult?
Well, it's difficult because we're doing everything down at 5,000 feet. From my perspective, you know, we've got a spill, and the spill is what it is. Whether it's 5,000 or 50,000 barrels, we've got to deal with it and try to help Mother Nature to clean it up and not do something that would cause more damage to our environment. So this is a bad situation, and it's what it is, regardless of whether it's 5,000 or 50,000 barrels. Ultimately, it would be nice to know the Ixtoc blowout in the Bay of Campeche appeared to be roughly 10 times larger than this current spill. It lasted 9 months. We have that as a baseline for understanding what kind of impacts may have on the Gulf. A substantially different kind of oil, and certainly was much further from our coastline than the current spill. But it was a blowout spill in the Gulf. So, and we know what long-term consequences there was from the Ixtoc, which was, thank goodness, not very significant along the coast. So I'm not too terribly worried about how much is there. I'm worried about, you know, what are we going to do with the oil that is being spilled. There's a number of technologies that are being used both above water and below water to try to minimize the impacts. Hopefully those minimize impacts and do not exacerbate the damage. And that's really the issue is, you know, are we doing anything to help or to hurt the mitigation of this spill?
Well, let me turn to Professor Hester. I'm sure that your concern, based on your background, is what's the impact going to be on coastal ecology? I wonder, from what you've seen so far in the efforts to deal with this, what could you say about the effort?
Well, you know, certainly the first effort is to try to contain it and clean it up, you know, and hopefully stop the leaks. You know, try to minimize how much of that actually makes it into the nearshore and actual wetland environments. Once it gets there, it's much more difficult to try to clean it up. Your cleanup options become much more limited, and of course, it could have very detrimental effects on the wetland plant communities.
And is this, you know, we have seen other spills in other places, and one of the things that I'm sure people will think about is what happened with the Exxon Valdez. Is the coastal environment here now, we're talking about the Gulf Coast, is that fragile enough or certainly more fragile that the process of trying to clean up, if the oil does get there, is going to be more difficult?
Well, I could address that, I guess, from the extensive coastal wetlands we have, that does make it much more difficult in terms of cleanup. Oil that may make it to a sandy beach, you know, could be, you know, would certainly be probably the easiest coastal environment to clean up as far as actually emergent coastline, and that would be easier than like a pebble or gravel beach like they had in Alaska. But certainly, you know, the vast areas of wetlands we have here makes that very unique and makes the whole nursery habitat of the Gulf of Mexico and especially the Mississippi Delta that much more vulnerable and that much more of a concern. Once it gets into a wetland, like I say, you have to be very careful in how you choose to clean it up, if at all, because oftentimes you can cause more damage trying to clean up the oil spill once it's in the actual emergent wetlands.
Yeah. I don't know, Professor Overton, was there anything that you'd...
Yes, I'd like to add a couple of comments.
Sure.
First of all, the Exxon Valdez was a lot of oil spilled over a short period of time. So the tanker ran aground and basically dumped its cargo in a day or two. That was a black tide. It did severely impact the areas in the western Prince William Sound. The spill was over fairly quickly, though. It was all the oil that had spilled had been washed ashore in the first month or so, and there was a lot of cleanup effort, and there was a lot of resuspension and efforts like that for the next several years. But this was a spill that happened, and it impacted a very high tidal type of coastline. The tides come in and out twice a day, and they've got 20 to 30 feet of tidal flow. In Louisiana, we've got a significantly different situation now. We've got a much lower flow, regardless of what numbers you believe, but it's occurring over a much, much longer period of time. I mean, the ultimate solution to stopping this is going to be the relief well, and that can take, you know, most of the summer to stop the ultimate flow. So it's going to be a slow-moving spill. We're going to be spilling fresh oil into the Gulf over the entire line, and we don't have big tidal flows along the Gulf, so it's mostly marshy shoreline. And as Mark said, those are by far and away the more fragile coastlines. If you could put them on a scale of what is your most fragile coastlines, of course the marshy coastlines are the most fragile. So we're relatively close to land. The Ixtoc was 500 miles away. This is 50 miles away, and it's a very long-term spill that we're worried about. The good news is that this oil is very easily to degrade. It is degrading fairly quickly. A good bit of it is being dispersed. I think they're making a Herculean effort to try to get as much offshore. And so far, I don't believe we've had really significant coastal impacts. But that's not saying much because, remember, we're in the first inning of a nine-inning game here. And, And this is going to be a slugfest, and we're going to have to be cleaning up the coastline for a long time to come. It's not all coming ashore like it did in the Exxon Valdez.
Yeah.
There was a black tide, and in this case, there is no black tide. There's a bunch of globs of oil that keep coming ashore, and then some of it washes back up. So it's a long-term fight against this monster that's out there.
Well, let me, again, here turn back to Professor Hester. What do we know at this point about how the coastline has been affected and how, over what sort of area are we talking about?
Well, there's direct impacts into the wetlands so far have been primarily in the actual Mississippi Delta, Southwest Pass area. Some of it has gone into Chandelier Sound, Breton Sound, to the east of the Delta. I have a couple large research projects on the barrier islands to the west, to the far west, the last two westernmost islands in Louisiana, and those both started having tar balls basically come up on them beginning, I guess it was Wednesday of last week. So there is, you know, oil that's down there, some of the oil that sank, you know, beneath the surface, and some of that is making its way up to the beaches, but fortunately, none of it in that area has really penetrated into the estuary and into the marshes, the salt marshes there. That's been primarily restricted to the fringing areas of the Delta itself and into Breton Sound.
Mm.
So that's very fortunate. I just want to agree with that. You know, one of the big problems of this spill is that, you know, we have a lot of people out there, a lot of fishermen that are, you know, basically on hold right now. They have large areas that have been closed to commercial fishing, and they want to do whatever they can to help. And it's great if they can help with, you know, containment booms and things like that. Like I said, the best thing people can do now is try to, you know, contain the spill and do whatever we can to keep it out of the fragile wetlands. And I just think that's key. I just like to reiterate that, as Ed said, you know, this is an ongoing spill, and even once we do have oil going up into some of the wetlands, it won't really do any good to start cleaning it up until we know that that particular wetland is not going to be subject to any future oiling.
Hmm.
A lot of times some of the responses you have, if you respond at all, are pretty much limited to a one-time thing to minimize, again, any mechanical damage or other damage to the wetland during cleanup. So that makes it a real challenge. So it's key that we keep them out of the wetlands as best we can, keep that oil out of the wetlands.
Let me introduce again the guests for anyone who has just tuned in, and we have some callers we'll take. The last person you heard, that's Mark Hester. He's a biologist. He works at the Coastal Plant Ecology Lab at University of Louisiana at Lafayette. He's a wetland coastal plant ecologist. And also joining us is Edward Overton. He's an emeritus professor at Louisiana State University Baton Rouge in the School of Coast and the Environment. He's a chemist and has done a lot of work in the area of dealing with emergency chemical spills, developing methods to detect, assess, and deal with these sorts of things. And we're talking about, trying to talk some about the oil spill that now has been going on for several weeks in the Gulf after the explosion at the Deepwater Horizon oil rig. That was on April 20th. It exploded. There was an explosion on the 20th. 2 days later, it sank. A number of people were killed, and it has continued to leak oil ever since. And so we're trying to talk a little bit about the environmental impact and how scientists and others may be able to deal with it. And we have several questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And we have email. You can send along your question that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. We have several callers. So we'll try to go right to them. And again, callers will help us by trying to be brief with their comments. That way we can get in as many as possible. We'll start out with someone in Belgium community, line number four. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. Now, the comments I'm going to say, I'm not trying to protect the oil companies in any way, but I'd just like to go on with the aspect you said about not going into the wetlands very often because even your actual going there destroys the property. This dispersant that we're pushing down into the deep ocean makes me wonder about things. But the question I have is, historically, there's been seeps that have been all the world. The most famous one that we know of is the La Brea tar pits out in Southern California. There were seeps all over the United States at different times. That's how we found petroleum. And then in the ancient world, they used petroleum seeps as a resource and for various processes they use. Isn't there a possibility that Mother Nature could possibly clean this up as good as we can?
Well, all right. I don't know which of you guys would like to try and you can certainly both respond. Maybe let me. I'll just pick Mark Hester. Can you maybe make some response?
Yeah, I think what I would do is I'll talk a little bit about how the plants may respond to some of those different types of oils and how they may weather and lose some of their toxicity, and then I'll turn it back over to Ed. He certainly knows a lot more about the actual chemistry of the different types of oils.
Okay.
So one of the things that happens, you know, as a spill ages is you lose some of those lighter compounds. The lighter weight oils will volatilize. And if a spill happens close to a wetland or an estuary and impacts it fairly quickly, those lighter oil fractions, or if it's a spill of more refined, lighter oil, that appears to have the most detrimental effect on the plants. That can actually kill the above-ground tissue. In the worst-case scenario is to have it come in, have a high tide, raise it up, coat the above-ground stems and leaves, and then have the tide recede and draw it into the sediment. If it's a weathered oil, which looks like a lot of this will be when it impacts the wetlands, it's much less toxic, directly toxic to the vegetation, but it can still have essentially a smothering effect. If it coats the plant leaves and stems, these wetland plants are actually very highly adapted to transport oxygen from the atmosphere down their stems and leaves and into the roots where they grow, you know, in a flooded sediment. So oxygen is always very limited or absent in wetland sediments. So these plants need a connection with the atmosphere to basically, you know, fix carbon dioxide and also, you know, make sugars and, you know, form the base of the food chain, of course, but also to get oxygen to the below-ground living structures of the plants. If the above-ground part of a plant is killed, the plant has a good chance, of recovering and then growing back, especially if that oil is then more weathered or has lost a lot of those lighter, more toxic compounds, when the new stems emerge from the below-ground, you know, below-ground reserves, the rhizomes and things like that. So the new stems can then often emerge. And as the caller said, oftentimes a wetland can kind of heal itself in that regard. It's usually better if a spill impacts a wetland as far as minimizing impact if it's more during the dormant season. And then the new spring growth hopefully would not have oil that's as potentially toxic when the new stems grow through that. The plants right now, of course, are actively growing, and so that can make, you know, that part of that scenario is worse. But plants do have an ability to recover from whirling as long as when they're growing back, a lot of that more toxic fraction is gone. Hmm. And as long as you don't have too much smothering. Again, it depends. There's a lot of factors. If you have a very deep, you know, deposition of oil in a wetland, then that could block off gas exchange at the surface also, which could be just very detrimental in terms of the plants basically suffocating before they can grow back.
Hmm.
So it all depends. But, there is a good potential for natural recovery. And oftentimes, the least intrusive methods of cleanup, oftentimes just letting Mother Nature do its job are the best, especially once, you know, we know an area is basically not going to be oiled anymore, that spill is there. People like Ed could then, you know, definitely, you know, they would know what the chemical makeup is of the oil in those areas, and that it'd be time for a very very thoughtful decision as to how to proceed at that point.
Hmm. Well, let's then turn to Professor Overton, and maybe you can talk about what happens to the oil over time, and in time, does it naturally break down?
It absolutely does. This oil, if there's any good news in this spill, it's this oil is eminently biodegradable, and it starts biodegrading very quickly. It's a very light, gassy oil. So we are estimating that somewhere between 30 and 50% of it will evaporate fairly quickly within the first day or so that it gets to the surface.
Mm-hmm.
After that, the microbes kick in and start degrading it further, removing these light compounds, which Mark referred to. They are the quote, more toxic materials. So the oil is going through a series of stages. when it gets to the surface, because the way it's traveling up, it's really a light oil, and it's got gases dissolved in it when it's coming out of the pipe. And what happens is the pressure gets less and less, those gases effervesce out of the oil droplets coming up and allow the oil to be mixed with water. So when it hits the surface, it's already what we call a water and oil emulsion, or a mousse. And so this mousse is kind of floating at the surface. It further evaporates. It's mixed by winds and the currents and moved around. And all the time, the substantial bacterial populations in the Gulf of Mexico are degrading the oil. So the good news so far is that most of the tar balls that are getting to the coast are pretty benign. They're messy, but they don't have many of these toxic compounds. So there is some sort of smothering issue, and we are still evaluating just how badly that is. But this oil is really degrading very, very quickly. So this is why we want to try to keep it offshore, if at all possible. Let it degrade further, so when it does come ashore, it has minimal impact. Mm.
You know, I read at least one story, I think this was in the New York Times, quoting people living in New Orleans who said that they thought they could smell it. Now, I don't know whether that's really true or that's just being extraordinarily sensitive, but it did make me wonder about whether components can indeed aerosolize, can be taken up into the air and might travel that way and far enough so that, in fact, people on living on the coast would actually be breathing it.
Well, under certain conditions, it's conceivable you might have a small odor. I would be very surprised if there's much impact. That's 50 miles away, and this oil is really volatilizing pretty quickly. Mm. The people I'm worried about are the folks at the scene of the spill, because those people are living out there, 24/7, and they are living in an area where the oil is readily evaporating. So they are having to work in those ships and those rigs. Their air handling systems can filter out particles, but it can't filter out the gases that flow in there. So there is a substantial worry, at least on my part, about the health and safety implications of our cleanup workers that are out there. And they are really the first line of defense. We've got to have those people out there. We've got to have the relief rigs out there to drill this well. The only way to really stop this and solve the problem is relief wells. I think BP's drilling two of them just in case the first one doesn't work. But those people are getting exposed to lots of vapors as the oil percolates up and eventually comes to the surface.
Mm-hmm. Well, just I'll go on to these other callers just a second. Let me come back and pick up that point because you mentioned it before, and I just wanted to have you reinforce that. We have heard the various efforts that the company has made to try to cap the well, and there are different things that they have tried, but they also are working on drilling these relief wells, which, as you say, and as they have said, they thought could take as long as 3 months. So that would mean that they would continue to drill throughout the summer, and I guess there would be the potential for continued release of oil. It really is. Do you believe that is the case, that the real long-term solution to this problem is not going to be some sort of cap or siphoning off oil? It's going to be these relief wells?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think 3 months is the most optimistic perspective on when they could be drilled. So I'm a little worried that we're not talking 3 months, but 3+ months.
Yeah.
But that's the only way we're going to solve the problem. Hopefully these other efforts that they're making with the caps and the shot of material, the detritus in there to crimp up the flows, hopefully that will slow it down. But the ultimate solution is to intersect that well down where the oil is entering the pipes and pump mud and gravel and cement down in there and seal the well up, just basically seal it up such that it's no longer functioning by allowing oil to come to the surface. And that is the solution. The other efforts are a stopgap in trying to minimize the flow that we currently have.
All right. We have other callers. Next, talk with someone in Peoria. Line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. You know, my concern is these guys, I don't think anybody should drill until they get some kind of safety device that's absolutely 100% fail-proof, or at least 99%. I was listening to a report on this, and it sounds like there was a lot of shenanigans going on just so they can, I guess somebody may have paid off these guys that's supposed to be inspectors or in the energy area. To me, it just surprises me that we let these guys get away with what they do. I prefer to say people stop drilling altogether. Pay $10 a gallon for gas, and then maybe people will go force the issue, because it's going to do so much damage down there. And it's now they're talking about it showing up in the Keys. I grew up in Southern California when I was a kid, and I can tell you, I could verify for this, Ventura Beach. They in the early 60s had a couple of leaks there, late 50s, early 60s, and to this day there's still tar on the beach. So, it just surprises me.
Yeah, let me. I don't know, Professor Overton, you can talk about this safety issue. From my reading about this, the blowout preventer that they had there, that is the kind of technique that they use in other deep water rigs. From what I have read, BP, their reaction was they couldn't hardly imagine this thing not working. That is, the failure was just something that they didn't believe. They just didn't believe it could fail. And I also, though, wonder, the caller says something like, well, unless they could prove that their methods were 100% safe, they shouldn't be able to do it. Is there anything that can be made 100% safe?
Well, of course not. I mean, that is just the goal that we all shoot for. If anyone saw the 60 Minute piece Sunday night, it looked an awful, awful lot like human error. Just as the Valdez incident was human error, there was the engineering was not at fault. Human error was at fault, and therein is the lack of your 100% assurance. I might comment that there have been several. I mean, we've been drilling in deep water now for 5 to 10 years, and there have been some pretty horrendous incidents out there, notably Katrina, where one of these actual wells capsized. I mean, it literally was upside down after a Category 5 hurricane came through the area, and the blowout preventer worked. It broke the pipes going down, and there was no spill. So I think there was a sense of complacency that the engineering solutions were in place. If the scenario plays out as was played out on the 60-minute broadcast, it was clear that some things were done by people that were mistakes. There was some fail safes that didn't appear to be in place. They had that little gasket that secures around the drill string, and it was clamped in place, and they started the rig, and that damaged the gasket. So there's all kinds of issues that will come out, but that was a result of some sort of complacency on operator as opposed to the inspection of the rigs and all that. This rig had an excellent safety record. In fact, there were people on the rig at the time of the incident that were out there to present an award for safety. And so, we're going to find a lot more out about the root cause, but undoubtedly there are going to be better engineering solutions that will come out of this. Undoubtedly there will be better ways to handle these things. It always occurs, but at the root of all of these problems, of most major catastrophes like this, you'll find somebody was turning the wrong valve at the wrong time, or sitting there chatting with his buddy and didn't notice something, and that's what ultimately tipped the balance.
Professor Hester, did you want to add anything to that?
No, I agree 100% with what Dr. Overton said, and it does sound like that there was human error involved, and I think we just have to see how that plays out. I think, like Ed said, I think a lot of the fail-safe systems that were there should have and probably would have worked if they were basically functioning and and it wasn't human error. But it does sound like, based on some of the testimony from people on the rig, that there was indications that the blowout preventer had been damaged and nothing was really done about that. And, we can't really speculate on the reason why for that, but I would imagine that some of that was they were that close to completing the job and capping it. And, like Ed said, they had an excellent safety record up to that point. And unfortunately, I think all of us probably have been in a situation where when we get hurt or have an accident, even to ourselves, it's because we're trying to hurry at the last minute. And unfortunately, we'll just have to see if that was part of the you know, the reason for this disaster was kind of trying to hurry up and move on.
We're a little bit past our midpoint here, and I have some other callers, and I want to introduce again the guests for this hour of Focus. The last person you heard, that's Mark Hester. He's associate professor in the Department of Biology at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. He's a wetland coastal plant ecologist, and he's particularly interested in coastal plant ecology and restoration ecology, with an emphasis on the use of vegetation to restore degraded wetland and coastal habitats. Also joining us is Professor Edward Overton. He's an emeritus professor at Louisiana State University at Baton Rouge in the School of the Coast and the Environment. He's a chemist, and he is interested in environmental monitoring and also in things like developing methods to detect and to mitigate environmental chemical hazards, and also some of the techniques involved in emergency spill responses. And we're talking about the Gulf oil spill and its long-term consequences, and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and you may also email to will-talk@illinois.edu. Next, we'll talk with someone in Indiana on our line number two. Hello.
Hello. A couple things I'd like to ask about, more to do with sort of the morphology of the stuff. I'd like for you to say something about tar balls. When they hit the beach, do they disintegrate and cause a mess, an evaporation of any importance? I was wondering what's going on under the surface. You keep talking about things dispersing and aerosoling and everything. I was just wondering if there's anything comparable to like a horizontal lava lamp where you have a large bulbous collection of crude oil moving around below the surface. And will it do any damage to anything, not just the coastal region, but whatever fishes that are floating by and swimming by in schools and stuff, whether that causes any problem like that? Haven't heard any mention of that, so I'm presuming it's not that way. But after hearing the boy talk about 60 Minutes about who was doing what at that thing, I think about anything's possible now. So thanks a lot.
Okay. Well, I'm glad the caller raised the question about what's going on under the surface, because it seems that, Professor Overton, it seems that, according to what I read, the problem at the deep level might be more serious than it is the problem on the surface.
Well, of course, the we don't know a lot about what's going on down below the surface, and there are two things really happening. One is the oil is leaking. The other is that they are using dispersants to try to disperse the oil throughout the water column well below the surface layers. So there's really some issues associated with use of dispersants at the surface, and we're also using dispersants below the surface. The oil, as it comes out of the pipe, has these toxic components in it that Mark referred to earlier, the light ends. When you disperse oil below the surface, you are doing two things. You're dispersing these toxic components in the water column at, you know, 3 to 5,000 feet deep. There's also not much oxygen down there, but there are bacteria capable of degrading oils, and you're also providing the food for that bacteria. So when you don't have much oxygen, you don't have much oxygen exchange with the surface, you can readily use up the little bit of oxygen that's down there with bacterial degradation. We call this adding to the biological oxygen demand of these environments. So it's kind of a double whammy in deep water. It's you're dispersing the oil where there is more exposure to whatever's down there to the toxic components, and you're using up the oxygen and perhaps creating dead zones. The only good news is that there's just not a lot of biological activity at those depths. There's not enough oxygen to support vigorous life. So most of your really vigorous life, for instance, a tuna is really nothing but a big mussel swimming through the water. It takes a lot of oxygen to support their life's processes and their movement. So they are up near the surface where there's abundant oxygen. And, of course, all the juvenile species that Mark referred to are in a well-oxygenated environment in the coastal plain. So the biggest impact is potentially in an area which is least populated. Now, is that good or bad? I mean, it would be a lot better if we just didn't have any impact at all, but that's not the issue. We've got an oil spill. We've got to worry about it. If we cause a large impact to a small population or a smaller impact to a bigger population, that's really kind of the the options that people that are trying to manage this are having to deal with. Mm.
Any Professor Hester, anything you might want to add to that?
No, that's a guy. I think I hit it on the head. The oxygen depletion probably is one of the main concerns that's been reported. And of course, you're maintaining some of those toxins at depth. Both the dispersants and also the lighter compounds are down there then being dispersed. But I think recently it was some researchers with the University of Georgia working with University of Southern Mississippi, I believe, on a cruise. They found areas of, I think, if I recall, like 10 miles long, 3 miles wide, maybe 300 feet or so deep of these submerged oil plumes, basically made up a lot of that dispersed or slightly weathered oil. And so they were measuring oxygen levels, and they indeed did find, significantly reduced oxygen levels beneath those submerged oil plumes. So it's a tricky question, because I think Ed's right. If, unfortunately, in a situation like this, you kind of have to choose what you're going to do and how to minimize environmental impacts. And if you think about the nearshore and emergent wetlands, estuaries as nursery grounds, we know those are highly productive and overall more productive for sustaining ocean life than some of these deep, very deep ocean waters. But of course, I think the fear is if some of those plumes, submerged plumes, move closer to the nearshore, or some of those tar balls could come up on submerged aquatic vegetation, seagrasses, basically, that could be definitely a very detrimental. That's something I'm more concerned about is, you may have oil that's not on the surface but is submerged or partially submerged, and you could have a real devastating effect on these grass beds, which are just very highly productive habitats behind the Chandelier Islands in Louisiana and all along the Gulf Coast in Florida. This oil does move, some of these plumes move into the Loop Current and up into the Gulf Stream. I think that could be a major impact, of course, not to mention coral reefs and things like that as well, off the Keys in Florida. But so there are definitely, more nearshore, aquatic environments that I think could still be detrimentally affected from submerged oil, dispersed oil.
And the question about the tar balls, I don't know if that would be, you could talk about that, or better Professor Overton talk about that. What happens when these things wash up on shore?
Well, the tar balls are pretty heavily weathered oil. When oil comes into the environment, they undergo these, we call it weathering. And weathering is really evaporation and biodegradation, a little bit of photooxidation from the sun, dissolving in the water, mixing with the water to form emulsions. There's a whole series of processes that change the composition of the oil. So, and generally, it's going from liquidy and smelly to kind of a solid sticky mess, and then ultimately tar balls have sort of a jelly bean structure where there's an outer crust and a more liquid inner crust. So in general, tar balls are more of a nuisance than a real damage to the environment, particularly when they're the heavily weathered kind. You walk down the beach and you step on them, you got a smudge on your foot, but it's not causing significant environmental impact. So it does have an impact on the economy. People don't tend to want to go to beaches that are heavily polluted because they are there for fun. They don't want to have to get and go swimming and come out with all kinds of little globs all over your bathing suit and all over your feet. So there is an impact, but it's not nearly as serious. And ultimately, tar balls are assimilated in an environment and just degraded away. So tar balls are the kind of the final, close to the end product in the chain of moving all of the petroleum hydrocarbons from fresh oil into back to carbon dioxide and water.
All right. Well, let's take another caller, and I think this is someone who is in South Elgin on our line 3. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yes.
Kind of a two-part question. I was looking at one of the reflectors. Of course, whenever you're doing anything on the Internet, you always have to question the source. But according to this report, the Minerals and Services Agency of the federal government gave BP permission to do the drilling, but they avoided some of the environmental impact statement studies and reports that had to be done and that type of thing. And if this is true, was this rushed through, and is there a correlation between That and the $8 million that the oil lobby gives Congress every, you know, election time. Do we have to, you know, look at, you know, are there other instances where these things have been permitted without the proper procedures being taken care of?
Well, I think we're going to find out more about what procedures were there. Remember, we've had deep shore drilling now for 5 to 10 years at least. I'm not sure when the first wells were produced. And the safety record is pretty pretty remarkable. So I think there was a bit of complacency. What shortcuts were taken in this particular procedure, I don't think is public yet. At least I don't know about it. I don't know that there's any direct relation between lobbying. I think there's an awful lot of money changing hands, and I think you used the number $8 million. Frankly, I would have thought $8 million was on the very, very low side for the money that's being sloshed around Washington these days. So,
well, of course, that's just what was reported to congressional campaigns. Now, soft money and that type of thing, I don't even know if anybody can keep track of that type of thing.
Sure.
All right. Well, again, we're getting into about our last 10 minutes here, and I have another question. I want to thank the caller and, again, maybe very quickly introduce the guests. We're talking with Edward Overton. He's emeritus professor at Louisiana State University, Baton Rouge, in the School of Coast and the Environment. He's a chemist. And also with us is Mark Hester. He is associate professor in the Department of Biology at University of Louisiana at Lafayette. He's a wetland coastal plant ecologist. And we asked both of them to be with us to try in different ways based on their interest and expertise to talk a little bit about the Gulf's oil spill that's now going on now, been going on ever since the 20th of April when there was an explosion. The Deepwater Horizon oil rig there has leaked a lot of oil into the Gulf, continues to, and a lot of people are asking questions about just what sort of impact there will be, and we're doing our best to try to take on some of those questions. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Real quick, I'd like to ask Professor Overton, because I have read a number of articles about the use of these dispersants, and in some of the articles, questions raised about what exactly they are, that is chemically what they are, the fact that apparently they're proprietary, so we don't really know what they are, but there are some concerns about whether or not they might be toxic themselves. Is there some reason to be concerned about at that, and who really would that affect?
Well, we do know. I personally don't, but the company that makes dispersants is willing, with appropriate non-disclosure agreements, to identify what's in their product, and they've been told that. I intend to get that. I just haven't had the time to do it. But dispersants are soaps for oil, in essence. They help break up the oil particles into billions of small little droplets. And normally, most of the toxicity from dispersed oil comes from the oil, not the dispersant. You put the dispersants in oil, it's something like a tenth or a twentieth or a hundredth the amount of oil you've got there. So you've got basically a little bit of oil and a lot of oil and a little bit of dispersant. So most of the toxicity in the water column is due to the toxic chemicals in the oil being dispersed down in the water column. Heavy weathered oil doesn't disperse very well, so once it turns into a real thick mousse or a tarball, it just isn't dispersible. So you only really apply dispersant to fairly fresh oil. And the other impact, of course, in dispersing oil down in the water column is the depletion of the oxygen. In near surface environments, that oxygen can be readily replenished with wave action. In deep oceans, it's not easy to replenish the oxygen. So the loss of oxygen or the BOD in the deep oceans is a much more serious problem than it is in near-surface application of dispersant. So toxicity is primarily from the oil, and the other issue is the BOD and the damage that can cause.
Okay. Well, let's go on and talk to someone back here where we are in Urbana. They're the next caller. That's line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm curious. How far back were the permissions granted for this drilling? And just who was in charge at that time?
I think you're probably talking to the wrong folks. to answer any of that. The Mineral Management Service leases, makes the leases for these sites out there, and I don't know who writes the permits. I assume it's the Mineral Management Service who is the. These were done in not in state waters, but in federal waters off the coast. So I think the Mineral Management Service has the jurisdiction for making the permits. I don't know whether EPA has any permit position in these drilling permits or not.
But it must have been when? A year, 2 years ago?
Oh, I suspect it was longer than that. I mean, these projects are very expensive. They take a long time to do. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if this is not a 4 or 5 year process.
Well, I rather suspect that that might be the case. There's a lot of talk about the improprieties in the granting of the permits, and you almost get the impression it might have been in the last 6 months. But it really sounds as though it goes back to the previous administration.
It almost has to. I mean, I don't think this well was. I mean, they started the drilling, 6 weeks ago or something? I mean, 6 weeks from the spill date, something on that order. But, you know, these rigs are in demand. You've got to reserve them years in advance. I mean, there's not an abundance of rigs that are capable of doing this type of work. So, and these things are going for $500,000 a day, operational cost of it. So this is a long-term process. I would be very surprised if any decisions were made in the last 6 months. But, again, that's way, way out of my area.
Well, perhaps in future we're thinking about other kinds of discussions we could have around this and other people we could have on. We really, for this first program that we were trying to do here, we wanted to try to concentrate mostly on environmental impact, and that's why we have the guests that we do. But certainly maybe some of these other questions, regulatory questions, we can get to other days with some other folks. We are also coming down about 5 minutes left, and I want to go to another call. This is someone in Carlock and line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Oh, yes. They could have blown that thing shut with about a 10-ton bomb or something, a bunker buster, and create a crater down there and fill it up with rocks various sizes. They could have shut that thing down right away. And this, as far as I'm concerned, it's a national security issue. It should be done by the military and just like the Army Corps of Engineers or somebody like that.
Well, that's I don't know. Again, I would turn to Professor Overton. I don't know if there's anything you can say about that. I guess it's my understanding that, in fact, in Russia, they've actually done that. They've used, and I think, that in fact, that they were nuclear, some sort of nuclear device. I wouldn't feel comfortable with that, but some kind of nuclear device to shut off a leaking well like this.
Well, there's some reports, and I don't know whether they've been confirmed or not. You know, the question is, what if you've got a pipe down there and it's leaking, and it's not a controlled situation, but it's not totally chaotic. And if you go down there and set off a bomb, it better seal it, or you could open up the reservoir down there. So I'm uncomfortable with options like that, unless they're well, well thought out by people that know a lot more about the geology and the subsurface ecology in those areas. I mean, this is on the slope. It's in deep water, but there's surface mud down there. There's all kinds of things, and this oil is coming up under incredible pressure. So when you talk about sealing it, if you're going to use an explosive device, you better make sure it is really sealed, because you could certainly make a bad situation worse. And I think those are the issues that people are dealing with. We got a spill now, and what the things they are doing are low risk of making it worse. When you do low risk of making it worse, you also have a low chance of success. So a lot of this jump shot and these other devices they are using to try to stem the flow are partially being inhibited by, you don't want to do anything that's really crazy and find a 5,000 barrel spill turning into a 50,000 barrel, if those numbers. So there are lots of people that have offered BP lots of solutions. I've seen a bunch of them on the internet, but we don't want to make the situation worse. I mean, right now the impacts have not been catastrophic. We don't know how they're going to be, over the duration of this spill. We're all very worried, but so far it's not the end of the world, and our environment is back. We should, unless things get a lot worse, have a very reasonable vacation season along the northern Gulf Panhandle. We're probably going to lose a lot of the shrimp season in the Gulf, but there are a lot of areas out there where you can go and get some great sport fishing right now. Yeah. But people are canceling because they're worried about all the oil.
We're really at the end of the time here. I'm sure on future programs we can get to some of these other issues. I just want to real quick go over to Professor Hester and give you the chance to say, if you can, in about 30 seconds or a minute, any last sort of thoughts you'd like to leave with us.
Well, just to reiterate, I think, once we do have any of the actual coastal areas, beaches, dunes, or marshes that are oiled, just to, have a well-thought-out process before just any kind of knee-jerk cleanup, because people are so anxious to clean up any oil in an area, just make sure that's well-thought-out. And even in beach environments, there's certainly going to be interest in getting tar balls off beaches, but just be mindful of minimizing mechanical damage to the dune environments as well.
Right. Well, I want to thank you both very much. Our guests, Mark Hester, he's an associate professor in the Department of Biology at University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Professor Hester, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome, David. Thank you.
And Professor Edward Overton, he's emeritus professor at Louisiana State University Baton Rouge in their School of Coast and the Environment. And thank you very much, Professor Overton.
Thank you, David.
We'll take a break here. We'll be back in a little bit. Right now, though, there's this.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe offers versatile catering options for breakfast meetings, working lunches, or afternoon receptions. Services include a wide selection of food and beverages suited to any budget. More information is available online or at 244-2233.
Right now, we have an update on the markets and news for you, so stay tuned.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Let's go ahead and take a look at how prices are doing as we head into the midday in Kansas City. July wheat at 489 and three quarters is down a quarter. September is at $5 and three quarters, down three quarters. December at 519 and a quarter, unchanged. July wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 472, up three. July corn, 359 and three quarters, up three and three quarters. December, 379, up five and a quarter. March of 2011 at 392, up five and a half. July beans, 941 and a half, up a half. August, 938 and a half, up three and a quarter. September, 926, up five and a quarter. November, 919 and a half, and they are up three. July soybean meal at 274 is up a dime. July soybean oil at 37.32